particularly stood in awe of Augustus's vision, his own being notably weak. Sometimes on a hunt, Augustus would try in vain to show P.I. an antelope or a deer. "I might could see it if we could get closer," P. would say. "P., I don't know what keeps you from riding off a cliff," Augustus responded. "We get closer, the animal'll just get farther." "Let's hire Lori to cook," Augustus said. "Let's don't," Carl said. "Bring her into camp, and there'll be fights every day, even if she was a decent woman." "I don't know why you're so down on whores, Woodrow," Augustus said. "You had yours, as I remember." "Yes, that was my mistake," Carl said, annoyed that Gus would bring it up. "It ain't a mistake to behave like a human being once in a while. Poor Maggie got her heart broke, but she gave you a fine son before she quit."
"You don't know that, and I don't want to talk about it," Carl said. "He could be yours, or Jake's, or some damn gambler's."
"Yes, but he ain't. He's yours," Augustus said. "Anybody with a good eye can see it. Besides, Maggie told me. She and I were good friends."
"I don't know about friends," Carl said. "I'm sure you were a good customer."
"The two can overlap," Augustus pointed out, well aware that his friend was not happy to have such a subject broached.
Carl had been secretive about it when it was happening, and had been even more secretive about it since. When they rode into the little camp, Lorena was sitting under a tree, quietly watching them. She had evidently just bathed in the pool, for her long blonde hair was wet. Once in a while, she squeezed water off a strand with her fingers. She had a bruise below one eye.
"My God, Lori, it looks like an easy life," Augustus said. "You got your own swimming hole. Where's Jake?"
"He went to town," Lorena said. "He's done been gone 2 days."
"Must be a good game. Jake'll play for a week if he's ahead."
Carl thought it was unconscionable to leave any woman alone that long in such rough country. "When do you expect him back?" he asked. "He said he wasn't coming back," Lorena said. "He left mad. He's been mad the whole way up here. He said I could have the horse and the mule and go wherever I pleased."
"I doubt he meant it," Augustus said. "What do you think?"
"He'll be back," Lorena said. Carl was not so sure. Jake had never been one to load himself with responsibilities unnecessarily. To his annoyance, Gus got down and hitched his horse to a bush, then unsaddled.
"I thought you was going to Austin," Carl said. "Woodrow, you go," Augustus said. "I ain't in the mood for city life just now. I'll stay here and play cards with Lori until that scamp shows up."
Carl was very annoyed. One of Gus's worst traits was an inability to stick to a plan. Carl might spend all night working out a strategy, and Augustus might go along with it for 10 minutes and then lose patience and just do whatever came into his mind. Of course, going into town to hire a cook was no great project, but it was still irritating that Gus would just drop off. But Carl knew it was pointless to argue.
"Well, I hope you get back to the herd tonight, in case I'm late," he said. "There should be somebody with some experience around." "Oh, I don't know," Augustus said. "It's time that outfit got a little practice in doing without us. They probably think the sun won't come up unless you're there to allow it."
Rather than re-argue yet another old argument, Carl turned to Hellbitch. Even experienced men were apt to flounder badly in crisis if they lacked leadership. He had seen highly competent men stand as if paralyzed in a crisis, though once someone took command and told them what to do, they might perform splendidly. A loose group like the Hat Creek outfit wouldn't even know how to decide who was to decide if both he and Gus were gone. He put the Hell Bitch into a lope. It was a pleasure to watch the easy way the mare ate up the miles. With such a horse under him, he could soon forget most of his vexations. Then, for no reason, between one stride and the next, The hell bitch suddenly rolled out of her easy gait and into a flying buck. Call was riding along relaxed, and before he could even jerk her head up, he lost his stirrup and knew he was thrown. "Well, goddamn you, you finally got me," he thought, and a second later he was on the ground. But he had taken a wrap around his hand with one rein and held on, hoping the rein wouldn't snap. The rein held, and Call got to his feet and caught the other rein. "Well, your little plan failed," he said to the mare. He knew that with a little better luck she would have been loose and gone. She didn't fight at all when he remounted, and she showed no sign of wanting to buck any more. Call kept her in a trot for a mile or two before letting her go back to the lope. He didn't expect her to try it again. She was too intelligent to waste her energies at a time when she knew he would be set for trouble. Somehow she had sensed that he had had his mind on other things when she exploded. In a way, it pleased him. He had never cared for totally docile horses. He liked an animal that was as alert as he was, or in the mare's case, even more alert. She had been aware of his preoccupations, whereas he had had no inkling of her intentions. Now she was content to ignore her own failure, but he had no doubt that if she judged the time to be right, she would try again. He decided to find some braided horsehair reins when he got to Austin. The thin leather rein he was using could easily have snapped. Braided horsehair would give him an advantage if he got thrown again. And he had never been exceptional at riding bucking horses. "Try what you like," he said. He had begun more and more to talk out loud to her when they were alone. "I'll tell you this. I aim to ride you across the Yellowstone. And if I don't, it'll be because one of us gets killed first." The gray mare loped on toward Austin, once again easily eating up the miles.
Chapter 45.
Lorena was amused that Gus had stopped. He was not a man to miss a chance. If he thought he could trick her again, he would have to work hard at it. But she was relieved to have him stay. The 2 days since Jake had left were wearisome. Although she knew that he would come back in time, she was less and less certain that it mattered. For Jake had taken a grudge against her, and she suspected that he would be slow to give it up. It was puzzling to her, thinking back on it, why she had been so quick to trust him. Somehow he had convinced her that he was the answer to all her problems. She had felt an overpowering feeling of need and trust when he had sat down and began talking to her so friendly. He had seemed as eager to hear her talk as she had been to hear his. Only a month had passed, and in the last few days he had made it perfectly clear that he had no interest in ever hearing her talk again, and would prefer that she didn't. It made her sad. If she was always going to be so mistaken about men, she would be lucky ever to get to San Francisco. At times, waiting, she had almost decided just to take the horse and the mule and try to find her way back to Lonesome Dove. Javier had said that he would marry her and take her anywhere she wanted to go. She remembered the day that he had come into the room, his wild eyes, his threat to kill Jake. When she had nothing to do but sit around and think about it, her capacity for mistakes discouraged her so that she considered drowning herself in the little pool. But it was a sunny, pretty morning, and when she went into the pool a little later, it was only to wash her hair in the cool water. For a moment she put her head under and opened her eyes, but it felt silly. To die in such an element was only ridiculous. She began to wonder if perhaps she was touched, if that was why she made mistakes. Her mother had been touched. She often babbled of people no one knew. She talked to dead relatives, dead babies, speaking to them as if they were still alive. Lorena wondered if it was mistakes that made her mother do that. Perhaps after so many mistakes, your mind finally broke loose and wandered back and forth between past and present.
"Laura, you look downcast," Augustus said. "Not 4 or 5 days ago you felt keen and looked more beautiful than the sky. What's that scamp done to cause such a change?"
"I don't know, Gus," Lorena said. "Seems like I change every day."
Oh, like most people do, he said, watching her. She had a sad look in her eyes.
I didn't used to down in Lonesome Dove, she said. I mainly just felt the same from one day to the next.
Yes, hopeless, Augusta said. You didn't expect nothing. Then Jake came along and started you expecting again.
I didn't expect this, Lorena said.
No, but he got you hoping at least, Augusta said. The trouble is, Jake ain't a man to support nobody's hopes but his own.
Lorena shrugged. It hadn't been Jake's fault. He hadn't asked her to turn herself over to him, although he had accepted readily enough when she did.
I guess I'm in a fix, she said. He ain't gonna take me to California. Nope, Augusta said. Too bad Carl's ornery about women, or we could make you the cook, and all the cowhands could fall in love with you. Dish is near crazy with love for you as it is.
That won't get him much, Lorena said. Dish had been her last customer before Jake. He had a white body like all the rest, and was so excited he was hardly with her any time.
Well, he's got you to think about, Augusta said. That's more important than you might think. Young man needs a woman to think about.
I guess he's free to think all he wants, Lorena said.
Why'd you stop off, Gus?
Hoping for a poke, Augusta said. What's it gonna be this time, draw poker?
No, blackjack, Lorena said. I'm luckier at it. And what do I get if I win?
Augustus grinned.
I'll be your whore, he said. You can have a poke on demand.
Why would I want one, Lorena asked. The notion of a man being a whore amused her a little. It was so unusual.
Think about it a minute, Augusta said. Suppose it all worked the other way, and the men were the whores. You just walk into a saloon and jingle your money and buy anyone you wanted. And he'd have to take his clothes off and do what you said to.
I've never seen one I wanted, Lorena said. Except Jake, and that didn't last any time.
I know it's hard to think about, Augusta said. You've been the one wanted all this time. Just suppose it was the opposite, and you could buy what you wanted in the way of a man.
Lorena decided that Gus was the craziest man she had ever known. He didn't look crazy, but his notions were wild.
Suppose I was a whore. I've always figured I'd make a good one. If you win this hand, I'll give you a free poke, and all you'll have to figure out is how to enjoy it.
I wouldn't enjoy it, Lorena said. She had never enjoyed it, and it would take more than Gus's talk to change her opinion.
Did you ever play games? Augustus asked.
I played Spin the Bottle, Lorena said, remembering that she had played it with her brother, who had been sickly and stayed in Alabama with her grandmother.
Well, it's kind of a game we're talking about, Augusta said. Games are played for fun. You've thought about it as a business too long. If you win the card game, you ought to pretend that you're a fancy lady in San Francisco who don't have nothing to do but lay around on silk sheets and have a nigger bring you buttermilk once in a while. And what my job is to do is to make you feel good.
I don't like buttermilk, Lorena said. To her surprise, Gus suddenly stroked her cheek. It took her aback, and she put her head down on her knees. Gus put his hand under her wet hair and rubbed the back of her neck.
Yes, that's your problem, he said. You don't like buttermilk or nothing else. You're like a starving person whose stomach is shrunk up from not having any food. You're shrunk up from not wanting nothing.
I want to get to San Francisco, Lorena said. It's cool, they say.
You'd be better off if you could just enjoy a poke once in a while, Augusta said, taking one of her hands in his and smoothing her fingers. Life in San Francisco is still just life. If you want one thing too much, it's likely to be a disappointment. The healthy way is to learn to like the everyday things, like soft beds and buttermilk and feisty gentlemen.
Lorena didn't answer. She shut her eyes and let Gus hold her hand. She was afraid he would try more without paying her or even playing cards, but he didn't. It was a very still morning. Gus seemed content to hold her hand and sit quietly. She could hear the horses swishing their tails. Then Gus let her hand go and stood up and took off his shirt and pants. Lorena wondered what made him behave so strangely. They were supposed to play cards first. Gus had on flannel underwear that had been pink once. It was so worn the color had almost faded to white. It was full of holes, and his white chest hair stuck out some of the holes. He also took off his boots and socks.
"You had your bath, but I ain't had one," he said, and went to the water hole and waded right in, underwear and all. The water was cold, but Gus went splashing off across the pool. He ducked his head under a few times and then swam back. "Dern, that water was so cold it shriveled my pod," he said. He sat down on a big rock and let the heat dry him. Then, looking beyond her, he apparently saw something that she couldn't see.
"Lori, would you mind handing me my gun belt?" he asked.
"Why?" she asked.
"I see an Indian coming, and I can't tell if he's friendly," Augusta said. "He's riding a pacing horse, and that ain't a good sign."
His old pistol was so heavy she had to use both hands to pass him the gun belt. "Jake rides a pacing horse," she said.
"Yes, and he's a scamp," Augusta said.
Lorena looked west, but she could see no one. The rolling plain was empty. "Where is he?" she asked.
"He'll be a while yet," Augusta said.
"How do you know he's an Indian if he's that far?" she asked.
"Indians got their own way of riding, that's why," Augusta said. "This one might have killed a Mexican, or at least stole one's horse."
"How do you know?" she asked.
"He's got silver on his saddle, like the Mexicans go in for," Augusta said. "I seen the sun flashing on it."
Lorena looked again and saw a tiny speck. "I don't know how you can see that far, Gus," she said.
"Carl don't neither," Augusta said. "Makes him mad. He's a better trained man than me, but ain't got the eyesight."
Then he grinned at her and put his hat on to shade his eyes. He was watching the west in a way that made her apprehensive. "You want your rifle?" she asked.
"No, I shot many a sassy bandit with this pistol," he said. "I'm glad to have my hat, though. It don't do to go into a scrape bareheaded."
The rider was close enough by then that she could see the occasional flash of sun on the saddle. A few minutes later, he rode into camp. He was a big man riding a bay stallion. Gus had been right. He was an Indian. He had long, tangled black hair and wore no hat, just a bandana tied around his head. His leather leggings were greasy and his boots old, though he wore a pair of silver spurs with big rowels. He had a large knife strapped to one leg and carried a rifle lightly across the pommel of his saddle. He looked at them without expression, in fact, not so much at them as at their horses. Lorena wished Augustus would say something, but he sat quietly, watching the man from under the brim of his hat. The man had a very large head, squarish and heavy. "I'd like the water," he said finally. His voice was as heavy as his head.
"It's free," Augustus said. "Hope you like it cold. We ain't got time to warm it for you."
"I like it wet," the man said, and trotted past them to the pool. He dismounted and squatted quickly, raising the water to his mouth in a cupped hand.
"Now that's a graceful skill," Augustus said. "Most men just drop on their bellies and drink out of a pond, or else dip water in their hats, which means the water tastes like hair."
The bay stallion waded a few steps into the pool and drank deeply. The man waited until the horse had finished drinking, then came walking back, his spurs jingling lightly as he walked. Again he glanced at their horses before looking at them.
"This is Miss Wood," Augustus said. "I'm Captain McCrae. I hope you've had breakfast, because we're low on grub."
The man looked at Augustus calmly and a little insolently, it seemed to Lorena.
"I am Blue Duck," he said. "I have heard of you, McCrae. But I didn't know you was so old."
"Oh, I wasn't till lately," Augustus said.
It seemed to Lorena that he, too, had a touch of insolence in his manner. Though Gus was sitting in his underwear, apparently relaxed, Lorena didn't think there was anything relaxed about the situation. The Indian called Blue Duck was frightening. Now that he stood close to them, his head seemed bigger than ever, and his hands, too. He held the rifle in the crook of his arm, handling it like a toy.
"Where's Call, if you're McCrae?" Blue Duck asked.
"Captain Call went to town," Augustus said. "He's shopping for a cook."
"I was told I best kill both of you if I killed one," the Indian said. "It's my bad luck he's gone."
"Well, he'll be back," Augustus said,
the insolence more pronounced in his voice.
"You can sit over there in the shade and wait if you'd enjoy a chance at us both."
Blue Duck looked him in the eye for a moment, and then with a light movement swung back on his horse.
"I can't wait all day just for the chance to shoot two old worn-out rangers. There are plenty that need killing besides you two."
"I guess Charlie Goodnight must have run you off," Augustus said. "Otherwise you wouldn't be off down here in respectable country riding some dead Mexican saddle."
The man smiled a hard smile. "If you ever bring that goddamned old tongue of yours north of the Canadian, I'll cut it out and feed it to my wolf pups," he said. "That and your nuts, too."
Without another look, he rode past them and on out of the camp. Lorena looked at Gus, half expecting him to shoot the man, but Gus just pushed his hat brim up and watched him ride away. Lorena almost wished Gus would shoot him, for she felt the man was a killer, although she had no basis for the judgment. He had not looked at her, and didn't seem to be interested in her, yet he felt dangerous. Sometimes the minute a man stepped into her room, she would know if he was dangerous and would hurt her if she gave him the opportunity. Even Tinkersley had been that way. Some days he was harmless, other days dangerous. She could tell, even with her back to him, if he was in a mood to slap her. If he was in such a mood, he would hit her no matter how small she walked. But she wasn't really afraid with Tinkersley. His angers had a short life. He hit hard, but he only hit once. The man called Blue Duck was much more frightening. He might not hit at all, or he might do something worse.
"Pack up, Laurie," Augustus said. "You best stay near us for a night or two."
"Who is he?" she asked.
"One we ought to have hung 10 years ago," Augustus said. "Couldn't catch him. He's Comanchero. He's got a greasy bunch of murderers and child stealers. He used to work the Red River country from New Mexico all the way across to Arkansas, hitting settlers. They'd butcher the grown-ups and take the horses and kids."
"Why couldn't you catch him?" she asked.
"He was better at doing without water than we were," Augustus said. "He knew them dry plains and we didn't. Then the army blocked us. Mackenzie said he'd get him, only he didn't."
"Would he have tried to kill you if Captain Call had been here?"
"I wonder," Augustus said. "I guess he thinks he's that good."
"Do you think he is?" she asked.
"You never know. I don't underestimate him. Though he'd have to step quick to beat me and Call both."
"He didn't even look at me," Lorena said. "I don't think he'll come back."
"I imagine he took you in long before he got to camp," Augustus said. "I ain't the only one in the world with good eyesight."
"I want to wait for Jake," Lorena said. "I told him I'd wait.
Don't be foolish, Augustus said. You didn't know Blue Duck was around when you told him. A man might decide he wants to use you for fish bait.
Lorena felt it was a test of Jake. She was frightened of the man, and part of her wanted to go with Gus, but she had trusted herself to Jake, and she still hoped that he would make good.
I don't want to go to that cow camp, she said. They all look at me.
Augustus was watching the ridge where Blue Duck had disappeared.
Yeah, I should have shot him, he said. Or he should have shot me. He was the last person I was expecting to see. We had heard that he was dead. I've been hearing for years that he was dead, but that was him.
Lorena didn't believe the man was interested in her. Even if men avoided looking at her, she could feel their interest, if they had any. The man called Blue Duck had been more interested in the horses.
I don't know that Jake can protect you, even if he comes back, Augustus said.
It made her a little sad for Jake that all his friends doubted his abilities. He was not respected. Probably Gus was right. She should quit Jake. Gus himself was a more able man, she had no doubt. He might take her to California. He had made it clear that he had no great interest in the cattle drive. He had talked a lot of foolishness, but he had never been mean. He was still sitting on the big rock, idly scratching himself through a hole in the wet underwear.
Gus, we could go to California, she said. I'd go with you and let Jake take his chances.
Augustus looked at her and smiled.
Why, I'm complimented, Laurie, he said. Mighty complimented.
Let's go then, she said, impatient suddenly.
No, I'm bound for Ogallala, honey, he said.
Where's that?
In Nebraska, he said.
What's there? Lorena asked, for she had never heard anyone mention such a place.
A woman named Clara, Augustus said.
Lorena waited, but he said no more than that. She didn't want to ask. It was always something, she thought. Something to keep her from getting to the one place she wanted to be. It made her bitter. She remembered some of the things Gus had blabbed to her since she had known him. I guess you ain't so practical then, she said. Augustus was amused.
Do I claim to be practical? He asked.
You claim it, but you ain't, Lorena said. You're going all the way to Nebraska for a woman. I'm a woman, and I'm right here. You could have the pokes, if that's all it is.
By God, I got you talking anyway, Augustus said. I never thought I'd be that lucky.
Lorena felt her little anger die, the old discouragement take its place. Once again, she found herself alone in a hot place, dependent on men who had other things on their mind. It seemed life would never change. The discouragement went so deep in her that she began to cry. It softened Gus. He put his arm around her and wiped the tears off her cheeks with his finger.
Well, I guess you do want to get to California, he said. I'll strike a deal. If we both make it to Denver, I'll buy you a train ticket.
I'll never make it to no Denver, Lorena said. I'll never make it out of this Texas.
Why, we're half out already, Augustus said. Texas don't last much north of Fort Worth. You're young, besides. That's a big difference in us. You're young and I ain't.
He got up and put on his clothes.
Darn, I wonder where that greasy bandit was going, he said. I've heard of him killing in Galveston. Maybe that's where he's going. I wish now I'd have shot him while he was drinking.
He tried again to get Lorena to come over to the cow camp, but Lorena just shook her head. She wasn't going anywhere. And what's more, she was through talking. It did no good, never had.
This is a worrisome situation, Augustus said. I probably ought to track that man or send Dietz to do it. Dietz is a better tracker than me. Jake ain't back, and I ain't got your faith in him. I best send one of the hands to guard you until we know where that bandit's headed.
Don't send Dish, Lorena said. I don't want Dish coming around.
Augustus chuckled. You gals are sure hard on the boys that love you, he said. Dish Bogart's got a truer heart than Jake Spoon, although neither one of them has much sense.
Send me the black man, she said. I don't want none of them others.
I might, Augustus said, or I might come back myself. How'd that suit you?
Lorena didn't answer. She felt the anger coming back. Because of some woman named Clara, she wasn't getting to San Francisco, when otherwise Gus would have taken her. She sat silently on the rock.
Laura, you're a sight. I guess I bungled this opportunity. You'd think I'd get smoother, experienced as I am.
She kept silent. Gus was nearly out of sight before she looked up. She still felt the anger.
Chapter 46
Newt, you look like you just wiggled out of a flour sack, P.I. said. He had taken to making the remark almost every evening. It seemed to surprise him that Newt and the Rainey boys came riding in from the drags white with dust, and he always had the same thing to say about it. It was beginning to annoy Newt, but before he could get too annoyed, Mr. Gus surprised him out of his wits by telling him to lope over to Jake's camp and keep watch for Lorena until Jake got back.
I wish I could clean up first, Newt said, acutely conscious of how dirty he was.
He ain't sending you to marry her, Dish Bogart said, very annoyed that Gus had chosen Newt for the assignment. The thought that Jake Spoon had gone off and left Lorena unattended was irritation enough.
I doubt Newt can even find her, he added to Gus after the boy left.
She's barely a mile from here, Augustus said. He can find her.
I would have been glad to take on the chore, Dish pointed out.
I've no doubt you would, Augustus said. Then Jake would have showed up, and you two would have a gunfight. I doubt you could hit one another, but you might hit a horse or something. Anyway, we can't spare a top hand like you, he added,
thinking the compliment might soothe Dish's feelings. It didn't. He immediately walked off in a sulk. Captain Call rode in just as Newt was leaving.
So where's the new cook? Augustus asked.
He'll be along tomorrow, Call said. Why are you sending the boy off? Newt heard the question and felt unhappy for a moment. Almost everybody called him Newt, but the captain still called him the boy.
Laura can't be left by herself tonight, Augustus said. I don't reckon you seen Jake.
I never hit the right saloon, Carl said. I was after a cook. He's there, though. I heard his name mentioned several times.
Hear anyone mention Blue Duck? Augustus asked.
Call was unsaddling the mare. At the mention of the Comanchero, he stopped. No. Why would I? He asked.
He stopped and introduced himself, Augustus said. Over at Jake's camp.
Call could hardly credit the information. He looked at Gus closely to see if it was some kind of a joke. Blue Duck stole white children and gave them to the Comanches for presents. He took scalps, abused women, and cut up men. What he didn't steal, he burned, always fleeing west into the waterless reaches of the Llano Estacado, to unscouted country where neither rangers nor soldiers were eager to follow. When he and Call quit the rangers, Blue Duck had been a job left undone. Stories of his crimes trickled down as far as Lonesome Dove.
You've seen him? Call asked.
In all these years, he himself had never actually seen Blue Duck.
Yeah, Augustus said.
Maybe it wasn't him, Call said. Maybe it was somebody claiming to be him. This ain't his country.
Oh, it was him, Augustus said.
Then why didn't you kill him, Call asked.
Why didn't you bring the woman into camp? He'll butcher her and the boy, too, if he comes back. That's two questions, Augustus said. He didn't introduce himself at first. Once he did, he was ready. It would have been touch and go who got killed. I might have got him, or at least wounded him. But I'd have probably got wounded in the process, and I don't feel like traveling with no wound.
Now, why'd you leave the woman?
She didn't want to come, and I don't think he's after her, Augusta said. I think he's after horses. I sent Dietz to track him. He won't get Laurie with Dietz on his trail. And if he's circling and means to make a play for our horses, Dietz will figure it out.
Maybe, Carl said. Maybe that killer will figure it out and lay for Dietz. I'd hate to lose Dietz.
P.I., who had been standing around waiting for the Irishman to cook the evening's meat, suddenly felt his appetite going. Blue Duck sounded just like the big Indian of his dreams, the one who was always in the process of knifing him when he woke up. Carl turned the hellbitch loose in the remuda and came back to the cook wagon. Augustus was eating a beefsteak and a big plate of beans.
"Is this cook you hired a Mexican?" Augustus asked.
Carl nodded.
"I don't like sending that boy off to sit up with a whore," he said.
"He's young and innocent," Augustus said. "That's why I picked him. He'll just moon over her a little. If I'd have sent one of the full-grown rowdies, Jake might have come back and shot him. I doubt he'd shoot Newt."
"I doubt he'll even come back myself," Carl said. "That girl ought to have stayed in Lonesome Dove."
"If you was a young girl with life before you, would you want to settle in Lonesome Dove?" Augustus asked. "Maggie done it. Look how long she lasted."
"She might have died any place," Carl said. "I'll die someplace, and so will you. Might not be no better place than Lonesome Dove."
"It ain't dying I'm talking about. It's living," Augustus said. "I doubt it matters where you die, but it matters where you live."
Carl got up and went to catch his night horse. Without thinking, he caught the hell bitch again, though he had just turned her loose. One of the Spettle boys looked at him curiously and said nothing. Carl saddled the hell bitch anyway and rode around the herd to see that all was in place. The cattle were calm, most of them already bedded down. Needle Nelson, perennially sleepy, dozed in his saddle. In the fading light, Carl saw a horseman coming. It was Dietz, which made him feel better. More and more, it seemed Dietz was the one man in the outfit he could have a comfortable word with from time to time. Gus turned every word into an argument. The other men were easy to talk to, but they didn't know anything. If one stopped to think about it, it was depressing how little most men learned in their lifetimes. P.I. was a prime example. Though loyal and able and brave, P. had never displayed the slightest ability to learn from his experience, though his experience was considerable. Time and again he would walk up on the wrong side of a horse that was known to kick, and then look surprised when he got kicked. Dietz was different. Dietz observed, he remembered. Rarely would he volunteer advice, but when asked, his advice was always to the point. His sense of weather was almost as good as an Indian's, and he was a superlative tracker. Carl waited anxious to know where Blue Duck had gone, or whether it had really been him. "What's the news?" he asked. Dietz looked solemn. "I lost him," he said. "He went southeast about 10 miles. Then I lost him. He went into the creek. He never came out."
"That's odd," Carl said. "You think it was Blue Duck?"
"Don't know, Cap'n," Dietz said.
"You think he's gone then?" Carl asked.
Dietz shook his head.
"Don't think so, Cap'n," he said.
"We better watch the horses."
"Darn," Carl said. "I thought we might have a peaceful night for once."
"Full moon coming," Dietz said.
"We can spot him if he bothers us tonight."
They sat together and watched the moon rise. Soon it shed a pale, cool light over the bed grounds. The Texas bull began to low. He was across the herd in the shadows, but in the still air his lowing carried far across the little valley, echoing off the limestone bluffs to the west.
"Well, go get some grub," Carl said to Dietz. "I'm going over to them bluffs. He might have a gang, or he might not. You get between our camp and Jake's camp so you can help if he comes for the girl.
You be watchful. He loped over to the bluffs nearly a mile away and picked his way to the top and spread his bedroll on the bluff's edge. In the clear night, with the huge moon, he could see far across the bedded herd. See the bright wick of the campfire, blocked occasionally when someone led a horse across in front of it. Behind him, the mare kicked restlessly at the earth for a moment as if annoyed, then began to graze. Call got his rifle out of the scabbard and cleaned it, though it was in perfect order. Sometimes the mere act of cleaning a gun, an act that he had performed thousands of times, would empty his mind of jarring thoughts and memories, but this time it didn't work. Gus had jarred him with the mention of Maggie, the bitterest memory of his life. She had died in Lonesome Dove some 12 years before, but the memory had lost none of its salt and sting, for what had happened with her had been unnecessary and was now uncorrectable. He had made mistakes in battle and led men to their deaths, but his mind didn't linger on those mistakes. At least the battles had been necessary, and the men soldiers. He could feel that he had done as well as any man could have, given the raw conditions of the frontier. But Maggie had not been a fighting man, just a needful young whore who had for some reason fixed on him as a man who could save her from her own mistakes. Gus had known her first, and Jake and many other men, whereas he had only visited her out of curiosity to find out what it was that he had heard men talk and scheme about for so long. It turned out not to be much, in his view. A brief, awkward experience, where the pleasure was soon drowned in embarrassment and a feeling of sadness. He ought not to have gone back twice, let alone a third time, yet something drew him back. Not so much the need of his own flesh as the helplessness and the need of the woman. She had such frightened eyes. He never met her in the saloon, but came up the back stairs, usually after dark. She would be standing just inside the door, waiting, her face anxious. Some weakness in him brought him back every few nights for 2 months or more. He had never said much to her, but she had said a lot to him. She had a small, quick voice, almost like a child's. She would talk constantly as if to cover his embarrassment at what they had meant to do. Some nights he would sit for half an hour, for he came to like her talk, though he had long since forgotten what she had said. But when she talked, her face would relax for a while, her eyes lose their fright. She would clasp his hand while she talked. One night she buttoned his shirt. And when he was ready to leave, always a need to leave, to be away, would come over him. She would look at him with fright in her face again, as if she had one more thing to say but couldn't say it. "What is it?" he asked one night, turning at the top of the stairs. It was as if her need had pulled the question out of him. "Can't you just say my name?" she asked. "Can't you just say it once?" The question so took him by surprise that it was the one thing of all those she had said that stayed with him through the years. Why was it important that he say her name? "Why, yes," he said, puzzled. "Your name's Maggie." "But you don't never say it," she said. "You don't never call me nothing. I just wish you'd say it once when you come." "I don't know what that would amount to," he said honestly. Maggie sighed. "I just feel happy if you did," she said. "I just feel so happy." Something in the way she said it had disturbed him terribly. She looked as if she would cry or run down the stairs after him. He had seen despair in men and women, but had not expected to see it in Maggie on that occasion. Yet despair was what he saw. 2 nights later, he had started to go to her again, but stopped himself. He had taken his gun and walked out of Lonesome Dove to the Comanche crossing and sat the night. He never went to see Maggie again, though once in a while he might see her on the street. She had had the boy, lived 4 years, and died. According to Gus, she had stayed drunk most of her last year. She had gotten thick with Jake for a spell, but then Jake left. Over all those years, he could still remember how her eyes fixed on him hopefully when he entered, or when he was ready to leave. It was the most painful part of the memory.
He had not asked her to care for him that much, yet she had. He had only asked to buy what other men had bought, but she had singled him out in a way he had never understood. He felt a heavy guilt, though, for he had gone back time after time and had let the need grow without even thinking about it or recognizing it. And then he left. "Broke her heart," Gus said, many times. "What are you talking about?" Call said. "She was a whore." "Whores got hearts," Augusta said. The bitter truth was that Gus was right. Maggie hadn't even seemed like a whore. There was nothing hard about her. In fact, it was obvious to everyone that she was far too soft for the life she was living. She had tender expressions, more tender than any he had ever seen. He could still remember her movements, those more than her words. She could never quite get her hair to stay fixed. She was always touching it nervously with one hand. "It won't behave," she said, as if her hair were a child. "You take care of her if you're so worried," he said to Gus. But Gus shrugged that off. "She ain't in love with me. She's in love with you," he pointed out. It was the point in all his years with Gus when they came closest to splitting the company. For Gus would not let up. He wanted Call to go back and see Maggie. "Go back and do what?" Call asked. He felt a little desperate about it. "I ain't a marrying man." "She ain't proposed, has she?" Gus asked sarcastically. "Well, go back and do what?" Call asked. "Sit with her." "Just sit with her," Gus said. "She likes your company, and I don't know why." Instead, Call sat by the river night after night. There was a period when he wanted to go back, when it would have been nice to sit with Maggie a few minutes and watch her fiddle with her hair. But he chose the river and his solitude, thinking that in time the feeling would pass, and best so. He would stop thinking about Maggie, and she would stop thinking about him. After all, there were more talkative men than him, Gus and Jake for two. But it didn't pass. All that passed were years. Every time he heard of her being drunk or having some trouble, he would feel uneasy and guilty as if he were to blame. It didn't help that Gus piled on the criticism so much that twice Call was on the point of fighting him. "You like to have everyone needing you, but you're right picky as to who you satisfy," Gus had said in the bitterest of the fights. "I don't much want nobody needing me," Call said. "Then why do you keep running around with this bunch of half-outlaws you call Texas Rangers? There's men in this troop who won't piss unless you point to a spot. But when a little thing like Maggie, who ain't the strongest person in the world, gets a need for you, you head for the river and clean your gun." "Well, I might need my gun," Call said. But he was aware that Gus always got the better of their arguments. All his life he had been careful to control experience as best he could, and then something had happened that was forever beyond his control, just because he had wanted to find out about the business with women. For years he had stayed to himself and felt critical of men who were always running to whores. Then he had done it himself and made a mockery of his own rules. Something about the girl, her timidity, or just the lonely way she looked, sitting by her window, had drawn him. And somehow, within the little bits of pleasure, a great pain had been concealed, one that had hurt him far more than the three bullets he had taken in battle over the years. When the boy was born, it got worse. For the first 2 years, he was in torment over what to do. Gus claimed Maggie had said the boy was Call's, but how could she know for sure? Maggie hadn't had it in her to refuse a man. It was the only reason she was a whore, Call had decided. She just couldn't turn away any kind of love. He felt it must all count as love in her thinking, the cowboys and the gamblers. Maybe she just thought it was the best love she could get. A few times he almost swayed, almost went back to marry her, though it would have meant disgrace. Maybe the boy was his. Maybe it was the proper thing to do, although it would mean leaving the Rangers. A time or two he even stood up to go to her, but his resolve always broke.
He just could not go back. The night he heard she was dead, he left the town without a word to anyone and rode up the river alone for a week. He knew at once that he had forever lost the chance to right himself, that he would never again be able to feel that he was the man he had wanted to be. The man he had wanted to be would never have gone to Maggie in the first place. He felt like a cheat. He was the most respected man on the border, and yet a whore had a claim on him. He had ignored the claim, and the woman died. But somehow the claim remained, like a weight he had to carry forever. The boy growing up in the village, first with a Mexican family and then with the Hat Creek outfit, was a living reminder of his failure. With the boy there, he could never be free of the memory and the guilt. He would have given almost anything just to erase the memory, not to have it a part of his past or in his mind. But of course he couldn't do that. It was his forever, like the long scar on his back, the result of having let a horse throw him through a glass window. Occasionally, Gus would try to get him to claim the boy, but Call wouldn't. He knew that he probably should. Not out of certainty so much as decency, but he couldn't. It meant an admission he couldn't make, an admission that he had failed someone. It had never happened in battle, such failure. Yet it happened in a little room over a saloon because of a small woman who couldn't keep her hair fixed. It was strange to him that such a failure could seem so terrible, and yet it did. It was such a torment when he thought of it that he eventually tried to avoid all situations in which women were mentioned. Only that way could he keep the matter out of mind for a stretch of time. But it always came back, for sooner or later men around the campfires, the wagon, the outfit would begin to talk of whores. And the thought of Maggie would sting his mind as sweat stings a cut. He had only seen her for a few months. The memory should have died, and yet it wouldn't. It had a terrible life different from any other memory. He had seen terrible things in battle and had mostly forgotten them, and yet he couldn't forget the sad look in Maggie's eyes when she mentioned that she wished he'd say her name. It made no sense that such a statement could haunt him for years, but as he got older, instead of seeming less important, it became more important. It seemed to undermine all that he was, or the people thought he was. It made all his trying, his work and discipline, seem fraudulent, and caused him to wonder if his life had made sense at all. What he wanted most was what he couldn't have, for it not to have happened, any of it. Better by far never to have known the pleasure than to have the pain that followed. Maggie had been a weak woman, and yet her weakness had all but slaughtered his strength. Sometimes just the thought of her made him feel that he shouldn't pretend to lead men anymore. Sitting on the low bluff, watching the moon climb the dark sky, he felt the old sadness again. He felt almost that he didn't belong with the very men he was leading, and that he ought to just leave, ride west, let the herd go, let Montana go, be done with the whole business of leading men. It was peculiar to seem so infallible in their eyes, and yet feel so empty and sad when he thought of himself. Call could faintly hear the Irishman still singing to the cattle. Once more the Texas bull lowed. He wondered if all men felt such disappointment when thinking of themselves. He didn't know. Maybe most men didn't think of themselves. Probably P.I. gave no more thought to his life than he did to which side of a horse he approached. Probably, too, P.I. had no Maggie, which was only another irony of his leadership. P. had been faithful to his tenets, whereas he had not. And yet, Call remembered, that very day he had seen Gus McCrae cry over a woman who had been gone 15 years and more. Gus, of all men he knew, the most nonchalant. Finally, he felt a little better, as he always did if he stayed alone long enough. The breeze flicked over the little bluff. Occasionally the hell bitch pawed the ground. At night he let her graze on the end of a long rope, but this time he carefully wrapped the end of the rope around his waist before lying back against his saddle to sleep. If Blue Duck was really in the vicinity, a little extra caution might pay.
Chapter 47.
As Newt rode through the dusk, he felt so anxious that he began to get a headache. Often that would happen when he felt a lot was expected of him. By the time he had ridden a couple of miles, he began to have strong apprehensions. What if he missed Lorena's camp? Mr. Gus had said it was due east, but Newt couldn't be sure he was traveling due east. If he missed the camp, there was no doubt in his mind that he would be disgraced. It would make him a permanent laughingstock, and Dish Bogat would probably refuse to have anything more to do with him. It was widely known that Dish was partial to Lorena. It was a great relief to him when Mouse nickered and Lorena's horse nickered back. At least that disgrace had been avoided. He loped on to the little camp, and at first he couldn't see Lorena at all, just the horse and the mule. Then he finally saw her sitting with her back against a tree. He had spent most of the ride rehearsing things that he might say to her, but at the sight of her, he completely forgot them all. He slowed Mouse to a walk in the hope of thinking up something to say before he had to speak, but for some reason his mind wouldn't work. He also found that he couldn't breathe easily. Lorena looked up when she saw him coming, but she didn't rise. She sat with her back against the tree and waited for him to explain himself. Newt could see her pale face, but it was too dark to tell anything about her expression. "It's just me," Newt managed to say. "My name's Newt," he added, realizing that Lorena probably didn't know it. Lorena didn't speak. Newt remembered having heard men comment on the fact that she didn't talk much. Well, they were right. The only sound from the camp was the sound of crickets. His pride at having been given such an important errand began to fade. "Mr. Gus said to come," he pointed out. Lorena was sorry Gus had sent him. The bandit hadn't returned, and she didn't feel in danger. She had a feeling Jake would be coming, even angry. He wouldn't want to do without her 3 nights in a row. She didn't want the boy around. The alone feeling had come back, the feeling that had been with her most of her life. In a way, she was glad it had. Being alone was easier and more restful than having to talk to a boy. Anyway, why send a boy? He wouldn't be able to stand up to a bandit. "You go on back," she said. It tired her to think of having a boy around all night. Newt's spirits fell. It was just what he had feared, she would say. He had been ordered to come out and look after her, and he couldn't just blithely disobey an order. But neither did he want to disobey Lorena. He sat where he was, on Mouse, in the grip of terrible indecision. He almost wished something would happen, a sudden attack of Mexicans or something. He might be killed, but at least he wouldn't have to make a choice between disobeying Mr. Gus and disobeying Lorena. "Mr. Gus said I was to stay," he said nervously. "Gus can lump it," Lorena said. "You go on back." "I guess I'll just tell him you said you were all right," Newt said, feeling hopeless. "How old are you?" Lorena asked suddenly, to his immense surprise. "I'm 17," Newt said. "I knew Jake when I was real little." "Well, you ride on back," she said. "I don't need looking after." She said it with more friendliness in her voice, but it didn't make it easier to do. He could see her plainly in the white night. She sat with her knees drawn up. "Well, goodbye then," he said. Lorena didn't answer. He turned back toward the herd, feeling a worse failure than ever. Then it occurred to Newt that he would just have to trick her. He could watch without her knowing it. That way he wouldn't have to go back to camp and admit that Lorena didn't want him in camp with her. If he did that, the cowboys would make jokes about it all the way to Montana, making out that he had tried to do things he hadn't tried to do. He wasn't even sure what you were supposed to try to do. He had sort of a cloudy sense, but that was all. He trotted what he judged to be about half a mile from Lorena's camp before stopping and dismounting. His new plan for watching Lorena involved leaving Mouse. If he tried to sneak back on Mouse, Lorena's mare might nicker. He would have to tie Mouse and sneak back on foot, a violation of a major rule of cowboying. You were never supposed to be separated from your horse. The rule probably had to do with Indian fighting, Newt supposed.
You would obviously be done for if the Indians caught you on foot.